Welcome, everyone. This is Reality Proves Possibility, and we can do better than this. And my name is Michael Pearson. I'm here today with Hunter Lovins, a good friend, a pioneer in the field of sustainable business, regeneration, regenerative economics. And so thank you so much, Hunter, for being here with me.
Truly my pleasure.
So reality proves possibility. We can do better than this. Any reaction?
Yes, sir. We can do.
We can do. Indeed, indeed. And I'm just gonna ch check in with you. Like, what are sort of like the core principles, if you were to share just basically what has been driving your life's work and your commitment that you can share with others?
To make a difference. And I never entirely know what that means. There's this old saying that 90% of life is showing up. I learned that years ago. I used to rodeo. Was a halfway decent barrel racer, lousy roper. And there was a two-day barrel race up the road from where I was. It was put on by a guy because he wanted to give a silver buckle to a particular girl, and the odds were he was going to do that because she was the best barrel racer around. So he had it set up that overall time of the 2 days wins the buckle, and she was going to win. Except the first day she decided to go to a rodeo down the road. And her horse was injured at that rodeo. So, first off, as soon as she decided to opt out of the first day, the guy said, fine, it'll be the single fastest time of the 2 days. And because she didn't show on the first day, I had the fastest time, but it was going to be over the 2 days. And, she was going to come and take the single fastest time. Well, her horse got hurt. She couldn't. And I wear the buckle. I don't deserve that buckle. I mean, there's the buckle. It is a silver buckle. I don't deserve it in that I was not, by any stretch, the fastest barrel racer around. She was. She made a choice, and I wear the buckle. Showing up is 90% of it. So, what can I do? On a given day, I don't know. Like everybody, I'll make a list of today I'm going to do these three things, and I try to get the three knocked off, and then the other 20 that are on there, try and make the best of it I can. Life's what happens to you when you were planning to do something else. A couple of years back, my husband got after me to retire, and I'd sat on the board of a little company which exited happily, and this astonishing amount of money landed in my bank account. It's like, wow. For the first time, I actually could retire. And I asked myself, you add up everything I've ever done. Is it enough? No, we're losing. We are in a climate crisis. We're in what's called the poly crisis. You pick your favorite crisis, they're all coming together. As Dana Meadows predicted that they would when we begin operating beyond the limits of the planetary boundaries, the human minimums, as Kate Raworth talks about. What happens is all these crises compound on each other, and you run out of the management ability to cope with them all at the same time. So we're in the poly crisis. Am I doing enough? No. Do I know what enough is? No. Then why go down the road? Why burn carbon? I live on a beautiful ranch in Colorado, stay home, ride my horse, watch an eagle fly. So I told my husband, I will. I'll hang up my spurs. Got asked to go on a trip, at which was going to be a guy with whom I had fought for 2 years. He ran a big UN program that I thought was going in the wrong direction, so I made myself his own personal heartburn for 2 years. And the guy who asked me on the trip said this guy was going to be there. I thought, well, this will be fun. I'd halfway enjoy to meet the man I fought for 2 years. Get to the event. He's there. He gets up, gives a speech on regenerative agriculture I could have given, I thought. So I marched up, said, howdy, my name's Hunter Lovins. He laughed. He said, I know who you are. Yeah, probably so, huh, after 2 years of my insurgency. I said, I may have been wrong about you. We sat down and talked, and he pitched me on an idea, which he called COP X. COP being the UN's Conference of Parties, which has for 30 years failed to solve the climate crisis. COP X is conferences of people independently organized. Build a global citizens' movement to solve the climate crisis by implementing the solutions that we have in every community in your own way. We're not going to tell you what to do, but we'll help you do it. And I thought, that would be enough. And this is a guy where it's not about him. He's still a senior UN official. He is in the shadows. He asked if I would head it up. And I said that I'll be your temporary CEO, but this isn't about any of us. This is about all of us. And so about a month ago, we launched. And I'm now getting about a ping an hour to COPX.global, people registering to become a COPX organizer wherever they are around the world. So far, every continent but Antarctica represented. And this is something each one of us can do. If you care about climate, if that's your issue, go to www.copx.global and register, and then begin in your own community in your own way. Years ago, a group out in California that works on climate said, we should all have a dot. Do one thing. Every day, ask yourself, what's my dot? What am I going to do today to make a difference? So that's what I do.
Great. So that's sort of like catching us up on your latest endeavor, and that it gives us an insight on that you're not yet retired and maybe you will never tire. That's great.
Rob what laughed. My husband got you. Laughed. He said, you weren't going to retire. I knew that anyway.
So what do you think is at the source of all that? Maybe walk us through just your journey, the way that you see it in a short film, short clip.
My journey. In some ways, I never had a choice. My mother worked in the coal fields with John L. Lewis. My father helped mentor Cesar Chavez, Martin King. They were around the house when I was growing up. So trying to make the world a better place is what you do. Took an undergraduate degree in political studies, sociology, planted a tree for the first Earth Day. Took a law degree because I thought law is the bloodstream of the society. Took and passed the California bar, practiced law for a couple of years, decided, thank God for the good environmental lawyers out there, but it's not the way to change society. So quit, became a forester. Planted, I don't know, a million trees or so. Got into environmental education, got into energy policy, created a little group called Rocky Mountain Institute, ran that for 20 years till they fired me. Created a little group called Natural Capitalism Solutions, which I still run. And along the way, kept asking myself, what will it take? Decided that business is the driver of most of the harm being created in society. So if we can transform business, is this the way to go? So I teach at Fordham University, teach principles of sustainable management, and work with a number of companies and communities and countries on how do we implement more regenerative practices profitably. If I can show a company that behaving responsibly to people and planet is just better business. You don't require polar bears. You don't have to have an environmental logic to get them to change what they're doing. So I and a whole lot of other people like Andrew Winston, who does this far better than I do, people like Solitaire Townsend in the UK, people working in the field of sustainable business are all working with companies on the business logic of behaving more responsibly. And working now on a, in fact, on a proposal you created that we work with business schools to teach this logic, that it's just better business to behave responsibly. What's your number? How many people a year graduate with a business degree?
40 million, if we add
40 million. Mm. If we can get inside their heads, not with an ideology, but simply the premise that they went to business school on, that we want to make a profit. Here's a better way to make a profit. So some years ago, Ray Anderson, the great industrialist, he describes it as a spear in his chest moment, where he realized that nothing about his company was sustainable. And he said, we're going to be the first company of the next industrial revolution, and set about to make Interface Carpets the most sustainable company ever. I was sitting with Ray in 2001, and he was annoyed. He said, this isn't why I did it, but everything I'm doing to enhance sustainability is enhancing shareholder value. And I said, interesting. What do you count as enhancing shareholder value? And he went through a list of seven. We then sat down and created a list of 13 reasons why behaving responsibly is better business. Things like, if you cut your use of resources, energy, water, materials, that's a cost saving. That will go straight to the bottom line. If you're not using toxic materials, this will cut your employee health care costs. It'll make you more insurable. When you commit to being responsible, you become attractive to impact investors. You become more insurable, and that's getting to be an increasingly important issue these days. When you commit to being responsible, you become attractive to young people who want to work for responsible companies. This is perhaps the most important reason. Once you have these good people, if you enable them to implement more sustainable practices as part of their day job, says Economist Intelligence Unit, a notably conservative group, you engage your workforce. Gallup showed that an engaged workforce is 24% more productive, 21% more profitable than a disengaged workforce. In today's workforce, something like 70% of employees are unhappy. They show up, but they're not doing what you're paying them to do. It's called presentism. If you can engage them, now you're going to be more profitable. It enables you to do brand differentiation, build brand equity in products. Unilever found that their purpose-driven, more sustainable brands were the driver of company profitability. It enables you to better manage your supply chain. Why did Walmart go green? Trust me, it's not out of the goodness of their hearts. They discovered that building the Walmart sustainability scorecard better enabled them to manage their, 100,000 suppliers? It cut the cost of distrust. It cut in half the number of people saying, I will never shop at a Walmart. Of course, they then blew it on the social side and lost a lot of that brand equity. But the companies that get this right will be first to the future. They will be the billionaires of tomorrow. So this approach we call the integrated bottom line. It's focused on the bottom line, what drives profitability. But Bob Willard used to be at IBM, now does consulting on sustainability. He took Ray's original seven, ran some numbers, and showed that companies doing this are 34% more profitable. That's a material number.
Well, so reality proves possibility. You mentioned Walmart, you mentioned Interface, you mentioned a number of companies that you've also worked with. And in some way, it seems to be better business. Yet, most people don't really seem to associate the environmental care and the social or humanistic approach to management with better business. In fact, they get cynical about it. What do you say to them? What is the reason that most people in business at least have a perception that all of these sort of good things aren't realistic?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm April Hardy, crime victim advocate trained by NOVA, founder of In Case I'm Murdered, and recent recipient of a $12,500 grant for intimate partner homicide prevention work. I've experienced domestic violence from both sides, as the employee whose performance suffered, and as the business owner who absorbed every cost directly. This is the Safe Work Advantage podcast that helps HR professionals and business leaders recognize risk, reduce liability, and protect their people.
Two reasons. One, we are up against the incumbent ideologies which say that the only measure of success is money in your pocket. The neoliberal ideology, the purveyors of those beliefs are very threatened by change in industry. And they have a lot of money. They tend to be the incumbent corporate overlords. And they have run a very effective disinformation campaign aimed at discrediting this belief that behaving more responsibly is better business. Or they have simply become bullies. So 19 attorneys general in the southern U.S. states said, if your company has impact as one of its criteria, we will not invest in you. So they said to BlackRock, you have said you are an impact investor. We will pull our state pension funds from investing in BlackRock, even though BlackRock is one of the largest investors in fossil fuels. There is nothing sustainable about BlackRock, and BlackRock proved that by caving and gutting most of their what are called ESG, environment, social, good governance policies. The other reason is our fault. Many of the advocates of changing how business is done came at it from a moral perspective. This is the right thing to do. You know, good old Ray Anderson was of that opinion. He said, I'm doing this because it's the right thing to do. Very few of us like being preached at, like people moralizing at us. You're wrong. You're a bad person. The way you do business is evil. Yeah, that's going to win you a lot of friends. And that was the way that a lot of the ESG was positioned. I think that was a tactical, strategic error on our part, and we're paying the price for it. The whole realm of wokeism. Woke just means you're awake. You're paying attention. But it was sold as you're a bad person. You're responsible for all these evils. And again, nobody likes being lectured at. We had this fight some years back over political correctness. If you tell a joke that has that somehow impugns a class of people, it's a funny joke. But because it impugns this class of people, you're now a racist. I've been canceled. I've been fired out of gigs because of, in one case, I cited the title of a book in print that had a word in it people didn't like. Got fired. Did I like that? No. So when the assault on wokeism came, part of me was like, yeah, high time. Part of me said, this was our fault for making this a moralistic campaign, not a business campaign. And, you know, I argue ideology over a beer, but if I'm talking to a company, I think that's not the best way to present an argument. So, shame on us.
Okay, well, so, all right. So we are talking about what's possible and that many of the things that we're talking about are actually already happening. They may not be part of the mainstream narrative and most people are sort of like stuck in a debate who's right and who's wrong. Not really what's possible. And that's maybe a venue and an avenue to get through and see still that anybody that is clear-headed and looks at the facts, they have to deal with certain problems. What are sort of the main problems that you see that we have to deal with, just to sort of specify, and what are the main solutions that you see that we can engage with?
To me, the existential crisis is climate change. I hear the arguments from folk that loss of biodiversity is as serious a crisis, and sure, it's a very serious crisis. Inequality is, again, coming at this from a business argument. Thomas Piketty, in his book Capital in the 21st Century, showed that high levels of inequality are causative of collapse, of economic collapse in a society. High levels of inequality is just bad for business. The proliferation of poisons, forever chemicals. The good news of today is that France just banned them. The U.S. is producing more of them. The breakdown in social order. I'm blanking on the guy's name. Peter Turchin up at Connecticut says, we're going to have social breakdown within the next 5 to 10 years. The economic collapse, currently brought you by the U.S. government, we could see collapse on a global scale, a 1930s level, very soon. You go to messing with global supply chains and things get a little dicey. Hell, the boat, what was it, Ever Given, that got wedged in the Suez Canal, mm-hmm. shut down global supply chains. COVID, of course, shut down global supply chains. Pandemics, that's another risk that we are facing. There are nasty diseases out there. Today's bad news is that a new disease has popped up in the DRC, the Congo, that nobody knows what it is, but it's killing a lot of people. There are all sorts of nasty viruses, bacteria, bad actors, particularly in intact ecosystems that we haven't gone venturing into and probably shouldn't. The COVID may well have been a weaponized version of a virus that came out of people going into bat caves to mine the guano. Probably shouldn't do that, or the wet markets in Wuhan. Preserving biodiversity is critical. Preserving intact areas is critical. So lots of challenges facing humanity. Desertification, we're drying up the planet. This has to do with climate change, but it also has to do with the way in which we do agriculture. Industrial agriculture is putting humanity at enormous risk. Saw a recent report out of Europe that the climate impacts on agriculture could lead to Europe starving within the next few years. And again, the real threat is all of these come together. And how do you manage all of them? Particularly in my country, as we're now firing everybody who used to have this as a day job. So get ready for really rough times. What do you do personally? There's several things to do. Historically, those who made it through rough times were in community. They knew who their neighbors were. They knew who in their area could grow a garden, was a seamstress, knew how to set a bone. What are the skills and the capabilities in your own community? Probably a good time to start finding that out. Where does your personal supply chain come from? So on my ranch, we have a 5-kilowatt solar system in the front yard. I drive an electric car. We have enough land. We have water. We can grow a lot of our own food. The idea that you're going to be a prepper and stand alone is nonsense. Standalones tend to die. But if you come together in community, share resources, share capabilities, and things really get a little Western, you may have a chance of making it through.
All right, so the big solution is community.
I think it is. And again, this is COPEX. Work with people in your own community. Look at what's your impact on the climate and how do we solve it. I was one of the reasons that I decided COPEX was the way forward was shortly after this idea was pitched to me, a woman came up to me at a local gathering and said, can we talk? Like, sure, we can get together, have coffee. She said, was I aware of the cement plant up the way? Yeah, it's a little hard to miss. Was I aware that it was the largest polluter in our county? 3,000 tons of CO2 a year. Whoa, no. Was I aware that the permit to operate was up for renewal? No. Would I help her get that permit denied? Yes. She was a homemaker. She was concerned that the pollution from the plant would harm her son. Had never organized anything. She asked if I'd come speak at a little rally. Sure. To count them, 9 people. Would I speak at a meeting a couple days hence? Sure. To 45 people. Would I testify to the planning commission? Sure. 75 people testified. I didn't do this. She did. All I did was give her the belief that somebody cared. And net-net, the permit was denied. The plant will shut down next month.
All right. So that's
possible.
And possible community. And this is sort of something that is shutting down an old model of operation, right? What is the new? You were talking a lot about the possible of the new. And I think maybe you can just give us a short glimpse, a 1-minute overview of how we can solve the major elements of the crisis that you outlined.
Sure. There are two real ways to solve the climate crisis, to be specific. Stop emissions by using renewable energy. These are now everywhere cheaper than burning fossil fuels. If you want the science on that, check out Dr. Mark Jacobson of Stanford, who has laid out how you run the entire world on wind, water, and solar. 2, regenerative agriculture. We have excess carbon in the atmosphere. That is what's driving the violence of the storms, hurricanes. It's what's driving droughts, floods, fires. How do we get the carbon out of the atmosphere? You do regenerative agriculture, which puts it back in the soil. So if you do Rodale Institute style organic gardening, composting, organic farming, that on its own can soak up as much CO2 as humans emit every year. You then add in what's called regenerative grazing, holistic grazing. A scientist in Oregon, Dr. Greg Retallick, we knew this. 60 million years ago, the Earth was at a concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere of 1,000 parts per million. When humans evolved, it was 280. Where'd the carbon go? It turns out it went into the soil. At around 30 million years ago, there evolved these little grazing animals that nibbled grass at the edge of the forests. Oh, at 1,000 parts per million, the earth is carpeted in forest. I mean, I've planted a lot of trees. I like trees. It's not the answer to the climate crisis. Grazing is. And over time, the grasslands spread. When an animal eats grass, the roots slough polysaccharide sugars that feeds the microbiological community in the soil, particularly the mycorrhizal fungi, that mineralize the carbon. It stays there, which is why when the pioneers came across the Great Plains of the U.S., 10 feet of thick black soil. That black is carbon. It got there through the coevolution of grasslands and grazing animals. We can replicate this now using electric fences, opening and closing water holes, with cows, sheep, goats, pigs, chickens. Regenerative meat production is essential to provide protein to people around the world, and it's essential to solve the climate crisis. No, don't eat industrial meat. Confined animal feeding operations where they feed them corn, which cows were never designed to eat, makes them sick. That makes us sick. Eat regeneratively grown grass-fed beef, lamb, pigs from local farmers, and you will be contributing to the solution to the climate crisis.
All right. So that's real. That's possible, right? And that's better than what we're currently sort of doing. And
it's healthier for you, too. David Montgomery, University of Washington, recently showed that regeneratively grown grains, crops, fruits, veggies, meat has higher nutrient density than industrially produced food. You will be healthier as a result.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Sarah Beth Herman, a five-time CEO and host of the podcast No Silver Spoons. This show is for leaders, entrepreneurs, and people building something meaningful without shortcuts. We talk about leadership, mindset, business growth, and the real lessons that come from doing hard things really well. And if you're in the dental industry, you'll hear a few episodes that speak directly to that world too. Because no matter your field, leadership is leadership. Listen to No Silver Spoons wherever you get your podcasts.
What's not to like? Why are we not doing that at scale yet? Why are we not putting this in place, right? Those are, I think,
there are very powerful incumbent interests that are subsidized. $1 million a minute subsidizes industrial agriculture. $13 million a minute subsidizes the fossil industry. Why? Because they buy congresspeople. They buy presidents these days. The meeting at Mar-a-Lago where the oil executives struck a deal with Mr. Trump. Yes, that is corruption. Yes, it is rampant. Mm-hmm. How do we fight it? Today is Buy Nothing Day. Just happens we're talking on this day, that I'm sure this won't be shown on that day. But the economic boycott continues. Check it out. Economic boycott. They have now a schedule of days where you boycott a particular industry. Show the world that those of us who buy stuff have economic power. That will get their attention.
All right. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Hunter. This is, like, I think, important insights and information on one hand, and that most of the people, including myself, did not know as much about as we should before you and I had been engaging more directly and deeply. So thank you so much for just sharing those basic tidbits of what's possible, right? I want to just turn briefly before we end to some personal questions and just give you a set of Marcel Proust's questionnaire that he gave to his friends, because I consider you a friend. And so give me a number. Give me a number, and I'll just sort of randomly
22. That's my radio number for the Boulder County Sheriff's Mounted Patrol, which I ride for.
32, yeah?
No, 22.
22, okay.
I am MSR22.
1 second.
Now you got to look it up. I should have given you that number before we started so you'd have it already popped up.
Right. Okay, so here it is. What is your greatest regret?
Greatest regret? Oh, that's a good one. My greatest regret is that I learned late. Make the people that you need in order to do what it is you're trying to do look good. It isn't about you. It's about them. If you need their services, if you need them working with you, make them look good. Failing to do that got me fired. I've been fired 4 times. I don't regret any of the firings. I went on and did better things after. It's a bumpy ride for a little while. But I went out to prove that I could do it, that it was about me, that I was better. Got fired. I did it. Brought in the biggest contract in the history of the organization. Week and a half later was getting to create natural capitalism. So if somebody matters in what it is you're trying to do, make sure they look good and are happy about it.
Okay, so making others look good when you're creating something bigger, right? Rather than making it
about
yourself.
You.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Always hire people smarter than you.
All right. What is your most treasured possession?
Possession? Right now?
Buckle.
You've seen this. This is a little piece of onyx. It came from a place in Egypt called Sekhem. It's Egyptian onyx. Sekhem is one of these treasures of the world. It was created, almost 50 years ago by an Egyptian doctor, physician, who had moved his family to Austria, or he moved himself and gotten a family. And about 50 years ago, he picked up and moved back to Egypt to create paradise, and did. It's an hour east of Cairo. You drive through miles of trash land, literally trash everywhere. It's not desert. It's not beautiful sand. It's just gray, barren, ugly. Turn the corner and there are flowers and trees and grass and a community. They have six industries. They grow a hell of a lot, organic, biodynamic, feed stocks for these six industries. They have a 600-bed hospital, four-year university, Heliopolis University. And working with them, helping them create the world's best carbon market. It's a thing called Economy of Love. If you go to Economy of Love Global, EOL.global, you can purchase carbon credits. 80% of that money goes to help lift poor Egyptian farmers out of poverty by helping them convert from industrial farming to regenerative farming, convert diesel water pumps to solar, plant trees that shade the fields so that they get higher yields. This is the real deal. So I carry a little bit of Sekhem with me everywhere I go.
That's great. And you know that we made a movie that is narrated by Ben Stiller about Sekhem. And yes, I that's another reality proves possibility story point, right? So it's fantastic, and everybody check it out. I'm going to give you two more. You choose which one you want to answer first. On what occasion do you lie? And what do you consider your greatest achievement?
When do I lie? Who was it? Leo Szilard said, never lie unless necessary. I will lie if I think someone needs to hear how great they are at that moment in time, whether I think they are or not. But I will always, in doing so, try to find something about them that really is great. My greatest achievement, it hasn't happened yet. If we can, when we pull COPEX off, that will be my greatest achievement. Prior to that, I would have said saving 1,000 acres of ground that was going to get turned into house lots in the old Snowmass Valley of Colorado, getting it into a conservation easement. It was a crucial elk migration route. The elk came from two streams, but they had to pass through that piece of ground to get to their wintering ground. And it is, I suppose nothing is infinite, but to the extent that the local government upholds conservation easements, it's protected in perpetuity.
Hmm. Great.
I did have to bet the Institute that we could get her done. But we did, and it's there.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Hunter. Is there anything else you want to share before we close?
Michael, thank you for all that you do. And this is not a lie. You truly are the standard bearer for this concept of humanistic management. You've built the Humanistic Management Global Network. Have how many books? 25?
Yeah, edited and authored, yes. Uh-huh.
You got me beat. And are putting forth this concept that people matter. You know, Janine Benyus, the great creator of the concept of biomimicry, says, in nature, failures are fossils. There is nothing that says that this human experiment has to work. And I don't know about you, but I'm a little sentimental about it. I want to see it work.
Right.
And we can create. What are the possibilities that together we can co-create?
Wonderful. Wonderful question and wonderful journey. And I thank you for being on with me here on Reality Proofs Possibility. We can do better than this. So, thank you again.
A pleasure. Truly my pleasure. Go well, friend.